This is Mae Warren. Today is the 27th of November, 1996. I'm in Lexington, Virginia with Dick Sessoms again. And we're going to talk about something that we didn't get around to on our first session, something that you were witness to, which was a real big event that happened here in 1984, the fire at the Phi Gam fraternity. You want to tell me about what happened that night?
Sure. I was serving at the time as the advisor, faculty advisor, to the Phi Gamma Delta fraternity, which was directly across the street from my home on Jackson Avenue. Phi Gamma Delta located at the intersection of Preston and Jackson. And my house on the corner there looked directly into their side yard, and I had been recruited a year earlier, I guess, to be their faculty advisor. And
was that because of your proximity?
Probably. Maybe it was, I'm sorry, it wasn't a year earlier, it was 3 years earlier. I think I was recruited in 1981, shortly after I came to Washington. In fact, I know it was.
Did you have any other association with Phi Gam?
No, had no association. Mm-hmm. I just happened to come home. I've been working here for about 3 months. I came home one day from the office around 5 o'clock, and there were a couple of Phi Gams playing lacrosse, sort of in the street or in the side yard there. And I simply struck up a conversation with them, which I usually do with students whenever I pass them, and ask them why they weren't home for the Washington break, and one lived in California and the other lived somewhere far away. So I had them over that night for dinner, because I knew they were starving. I said, well, I'll see if I can talk to the missus about it. So they came over for dinner that night, and we fed them, and we had an awful lot of food, and they just devoured it. And the next morning at 8:30, as I was leaving, or 8:20 or so, as I was leaving for the office, I noticed something in my mailbox, and it was a thank you note from one Greg Johnson, who was at that time the president of the fraternity. He was one of the kids in the street playing lacrosse. And I thought, oh my golly, his mom really taught him right, and I was pretty impressed with that. One friendly meeting after another, and by the late that spring, Ed Bishop, who is now a trustee of the university, at that time was the Alumni House Corporation president, came across the street and said, the guys over here, quote, think you're a hot ticket, unquote, or something like that, and we want you to be their advisor. They didn't have one at the time. And I thought to myself, well, I'm a new development officer at the university. What better way can I come to understand the university than to be associated with one of the undergraduate fraternities? So I said, well, I'll be happy to try. Although I myself am not a Phi Gam, I was a Kappa Sig at Hamlin Sydney College, my alma mater. But they took me on, and I took them on. Now, the Phi Gams were picks, bad boys, always were, and always will be, presume. One thing about them, in a campus filled with what some of us would regard as face men in the Greek system, the Phi Gams are kind of what you see is what you get. They're very real people. You may not like what you see, and there's a little aspect of that perhaps with them, but they are very much genuine and for real, at least all my experience with them. So I guess before I finally stepped down, I had been there advisor for the best part of 13 or 14 years before I finally, when I finally moved from that location. But they were in deep trouble back in those early days in the early 80s when I first came there. The house was a pigsty, and Ed Bishop and I were trying to do something about it. In fact, we embarked on several summers in a row of rehabilitation, and we'd paint things and we'd fix things. And one time we went back and tried to get the deep fat fryer. The kitchen was shut down by the health department. We were talking about a fraternity that was just in the dregs of its existence back then. And we had just begun it's a slow wheel turn, we had just begun to make some progress with that house. When in the spring of 1984, this great tragedy occurred. The situation was that it occurred during the spring break. The house was empty, save for one student who happened to be at that time the president of the house, the co-president. There were two boys who were actually sort of the co-captains of the team. And that was part of Mr. Bishop's program to rehabilitate them. We had decommissioned the present leadership and had placed some younger kids in charge because we thought the future demanded new leadership. Tom Fallon, the boy who died in the fire, was, I think, a young man that everybody thought would someday be a Rhodes Scholar. He had all of that about him. He was an athlete. He was very, very bright. I think he probably carried about a 3.8 or 9 GPA. Just a great all-around youngster. And lots of leadership abilities. And it just so happened that the night of that fire, which was traumatic because I guess my first indication of it was my own child, who at the time was a teenager. My daughter had her front bedroom on the Jackson Avenue side of our house, and she thought our house was on fire. She was awakened by noise, voices or yelling, and she came running back to my bedroom and on the second floor of our house and awakened my wife and I. And I looked out the window and I saw sort of an orange glow, and I thought the Spee house was on fire. That's the house on the other side of the fire game house. The fire, whatever it was on the far side. So I went quickly, tugging my clothes on, to rush across the street, promising my wife every step of the way that I wouldn't do something foolish. And went racing out there. So I think I was about the third person on the scene. The fire had been reported by a youngster in the Spee house, who was the editor of the Ringtone 5, a distinguished reporter he is today, Mike Allen of the Richmond newspaper. But Mike was one of the brightest Ringtone 5 editors we ever had, and he was about class of 85 or 6 or somewhere there. And Mike heard some noise and looked out of his window on the second floor of the Spee house and saw that the fire game house was on fire. Of course, dialed 911, and he went running down to see what he could do. In the what is the house mother's wing of the house, we had installed, Ed Bishop and I had installed a third-year law student named Jim Fort, F-O-R-T-E. Jim was a FIGAM undergrad at W&L and now was a third-year law student and a responsible guy and older. And we had him sort of serving as a house mother, might, in the sense that he was older and responsible, and he was helping us to bring some order and some stability and some maturity mainly to the undergraduate brothers. So Jim and Mike Allen were yelling and screaming, and about that time policeman arrived, was on the scene when I got there. So there were three or four of us who were running around trying to figure out what to do next. Fire department had been phoned. We opened the back door of the FIGAM house and were just absolutely knocked down by a thick wall of the most, black smoke. We literally had no thought of walking inside. You couldn't have lasted 5 seconds in this place. I've never seen such smoke just come billowing out. It was overwhelming. And every door of the house that you would crack would look like that. We had no knowledge that anyone was in the house with the exception of Tom Fallon. The reason Tom was in the house was because he was a member of the baseball team, and the sports teams during spring break had a schedule, and they had played in the office the day before or whatever, but he was on the campus.
and he was the only member of the fraternity on the team, so that's why he was there. We weren't sure that he was upstairs, but we, I guess, assumed that he might be. Anyway, I stood outside. We realized we couldn't go in. We were kind of wringing our hands. This isn't the first maybe 10 minutes now. The fire at this point was located over in what was the first floor chapter room, which is over on the sort of the back side of the house, but over on the house mother wing over on that side. And it looked like to me that that's where it was confined. And I thought, my first thought was, well, we will lose that room, but surely the fire department will get here and we'll get this thing out. We've got a major calamity on our hands, but we're certainly not going to lose the whole house here. That was my first thought. But the fire was raging. It was an intense fire, and the flames were leaping higher and higher. And as we waited those first few anxious moments, I couldn't believe how rapidly the fire was spreading. It just seemed to be coming out of everywhere all of a sudden. Within, say, 10 minutes, suddenly I'm seeing flames leaping out of other portions of the house that I just didn't understand. The fire department arrived. I guess fire departments from all around, Lexington, Buena Vista, Glasgow, Natural Bridge, everywhere a fire department, I forget how many fire stations did respond. And equipment, and they got there pretty quick. I mean, you know, after all, the fire department here in Lexington was, what, two blocks from the fire game house? And in terms of location, the fire was called in before it was too far along, but it was clear from rather early on that this fire was going to be something else to contain, and the house seemed to be going up faster than it should have. To make a long story short, it was a true roaring inferno, and probably, I would say that I don't remember the detail now, it's been 12 years, but I guess this was all occurring around 4 o'clock in the morning, 4 to 5. It's funny, though, that you can remember some things very vividly. I remember that it was cool that morning, and I'll never forget somehow that the fire was, that there were the water from the hoses and fire department hoses were dripping off the limbs of the trees and freezing. In other words, it was cold that April. I guess it was the 11th or 12th of April. And the water was literally freezing on the branches of the trees. Mm-hmm. Pretty soon the fire simply began to consume the whole place. The whole house was, the roof, every window upstairs, downstairs, the whole thing was ablaze. It was quite apparent you couldn't save the house. All the water and chemicals or whatever they were trying to pour on just wasn't getting the job done. Probably somewhere in the first maybe 30, 40 minutes, one of the firemen, several of them, whose courage I would have to tell you was extraordinary, did enter the house with axes, and they discovered Tom's body, which was on the steps. He was apparently trying to crawl down the steps. And his head was on around the second step from the bottom of the stairs. So he was in a crawl position coming down. His body was carried out into the yard, and I remember standing within 5-10 feet of his body, and frankly not recognizing it as a body for the first several seconds. It was that badly charred, and he was that badly burned. And we were in a state of shock at that point. The whole house was aflame. It's a stone house, and it was interesting that that the fire went straight up like it was in a chimney. The walls were still standing when the sun came up that morning, but the inside of the house was just about gone. Certain portions of it maybe were still standing, but if you've ever seen pictures of that fire or the morning after devastation, you recognize just how intense the heat must have been in there. But like a stone chimney, the fire just went straight up. Very interesting, because the trees in that yard, and at that time there were some trees that are no longer there, big trees subsequently were cut down, but none of the leaves or none of the limbs of those trees were in any way seared or scorched or burned.
Yeah, that was mentioned in the newspaper.
Yeah, it was
how remarkable that was.
So maybe about, of course, by this time, people in town were discovering, I mean, the whole neighborhood early on, as first light came, all the Jackson Avenue, Preston Street, Lee Avenue neighborhood was watching from a safe distance. I recall that the one of the students who was a senior at the time came to me because he thought he'd committed he thought that he had set the fire ablaze through negligence on his part. And so my first couple of hours that particular morning was dealing not only with my own emotions but trying to help this youngster. Lou John was then the dean of students, and Lou and I huddled in my living room with this young man and tried to console him. I remember taking him to R.E. Lee Church because he says, "I've got to get somewhere on my knees real quick." We were trying to get the story from him of what might have happened. And he and several other students, I'm not sure whether they were all Phi Gams, but they were here doing, maybe they were doing some geology project or whatever, field work or whatever, but they were also on campus. He was not living in the house, but he and some students had been in that house that night and had in fact built a fire in the fireplace. So the immediate assumption was that they hadn't put the fire out and that somehow it had spread. That was his own assumption, that was our assumption. Although he kept protesting by saying, "I know we poured water on that fire, I know it was out, there's no way." But then, and look what I've done, he felt like he had caused that kid to lose his life. So we were consoling him and trying to make the most of that situation. I want to come back to what really happened later on, and just sort of, as I try to remember it, go on to there. A great tragedy. John Wilson and I were to have gone that day or the next day, I can't remember, to a Northern New Jersey alumni meeting. There was a presidential trip involved, so Buddy Atkins immediately offered to take that, and I insisted that John go ahead and leave me to deal with the aftermath of this fire. I think Lou John called his parents. The dean of students always has that responsibility in those situations. It would be an awesome responsibility.
Called Tom Fallon's parents.
Called Tom Fallon's parents to tell them about the tragedy. And of course, we then began to make arrangements for the funeral and memorial services on campus, et cetera. Meantime, as advisor to the fraternity, I had to get on the telephone with, I guess, 12 young men who lived in the house. And talk about hard telephone calls to break the news to them. And many of them were on vacation, maybe in Florida or wherever, so I was calling, mostly I was confident on calling their parents, hoping that their parents could help break the news, but mainly to tell the parents that Jim or John or Mike or whomever has lost everything. And it was hard to get that message across to the parents of the students. You mean everything? Yes, I mean his clothes, his books, everything he owns has burned. That was most of the case. It wasn't, there were a couple of rooms that didn't get that much damage. Unbelievably, Tom Fellin's own room was not greatly damaged. Ironically, we crawled up there a day or two later and got to his room on the second floor, and his bed was intact, and the sheets, it was like he had gotten very calmly out of bed. The sheets were just blanket, just folded up. And it was his watch, his wallet, his personal effects were totally in place. His fishing rod or whatever it might have been. So that was hard to deal with that. And Dan Murphy at that time was serving as the dean of the Greek program, as Buddy Atkins is now. So Danny Murphy and I went to the the funeral service in Weston, Pennsylvania, a little Pennsylvania coal town, along with the entire baseball team, coaches, and the members of the fraternity that got the word and were able to get there. Most of them did. And I learned while at the funeral that Tom's father was a volunteer fireman. I had a long conversation with Mr. Fellin, who never understood how Tom could have lost his life in a fire, because he said he had too much training to have done that. And I said, well, it's probably because he felt this great responsibility and felt like he had to get to the source of the fire and put it out. So he maybe had. We finally decided that there was a fire door at the top of the second floor, and I think when he opened that door, he probably was overwhelmed by the smoke, because I know what that smoke looked like. Mm-hmm. It was, you can imagine a million rubber tires burning and just that kind of black smoke. Mm-hmm. It was awful. And my guess always was that he just was overcome by a blast of smoke, kind of lost his equilibrium. And even though he knew to crawl and be down low, my guess is that he just tried to get down and put the thing out and lost his life in that process. Had he stayed in bed, obviously he would be alive today. He just put his head out the window because his room, for some reason, didn't get the kind of... So we went up to the funeral. It was done at a Catholic church in this tiny little town. Totally little village. It looked like it might have been only one or two paved streets in the whole town. And of course, Tom was probably the finest thing that little town had ever produced. I'm emotional about it, even to this day, thinking about going to that little church. And I remember walking in the church, and the high school National Honor Society was serving as somehow ushers for the service. It made a great impression on us. After the service, Mr. and Mrs. Fellin invited us all down to the Fellin home, which was really a very modest, and I do mean modest, house, to have what could only be described as an Irish wake. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful wake in that sense, a healing, as it were. One of my great impressions, or one of my great memories, is the sea of blue jacketed, blue blazered Wesley baseball team and others walking down this little tiny street, thinking as in my own mind that some of them from the homes of the most affluent Highland Park, Dallas kind of backgrounds you can imagine. probably good, probably a big education for them to see that every student at this university doesn't come from that background. And he was such a bright kid. And I've got great, you know, memories of him as a student. I had been with him at Fancy Dress that year with him, his date. Well, his date was a Highlands girl, and she approached me at his home during the week. We'd all gone into the home, and Mr. Fallon had us all come in, and there were uncles, I guess, and others there, family, and we all walked in, and they all greeted us and wanted us to see Tommy's scrapbooks. It's really hard to talk about. Anyway, so I'm at the at this home during the wake, and his girlfriend wanted me to come out on the porch. She had something very important she wanted to talk to me privately about. So we walked out, and she was a bit unintelligible. I really couldn't make out what she was trying to tell me, but she asked me if President Paula Brownlee of Highlands College had talked with me as yet, and I didn't know what on earth that could all be about. And I said no, and we went on, and she began to ramble a bit incoherently about this person that she thought might be responsible for the fire. And of course, I remember telling Danny Murphy a little bit about this conversation. I kind of dismissed it, frankly. It was just too bizarre to even think about. But I remember telling Danny as we drove home about this conversation, and he didn't think much of it either. And I wouldn't have thought anything of it ever, except when I got home, the first thing I saw was that very day that we got back from the funeral, the yellow police, what do you call them, restraining ropes, not ropes, but you know, the plastic surrounding the house, and there were signs up about arson. And so I began to, for the first time then, give some credence to the story that this young woman had blurted out in her agony to me at the funeral or after the funeral. The story, as I guess the papers reported, was that there was a disturbed young man, a son of a Highlands College professor, who was enamored of a Highlands student, and a female, and that particular female, who happened to be the roommate of Tom Fallon's girl. That was the connection. Well, it wasn't a young woman that Tom Fallon dated, but a young woman that one of Tom's friends in the Five Gam house had dated. And so this young Highlands gal had come over to Washley several times, I guess, to date this young man. And her jealous, I guess, suitor over at Highlands, who was the son of the professor, didn't like that, and had repeatedly said that if you don't stop dating that Phi Gam at Washley, something bad is going to happen over there. That was the story. And you've got to think that's just bizarre. That's, come on, who could possibly believe that? And I wasn't prepared to believe it until we discovered that the young man who repeatedly made that, whatever you want to call it, threat, had in fact been dismissed from Farley Dickinson College for arson. He had been, in fact, dismissed from college for setting fires. So it began, you began to then say, well, my gosh, as bizarre as this could be, perhaps, in fact, he did set fire to the house. If he did, and I'm not saying that he did, but if he did, my guess would be that he probably didn't know anyone was in the house. He probably, if indeed he was the person that burned the house down, he probably chose to do it when the house was unoccupied. I can't believe that he would ever intentionally set fire to some weapon, but who knows? Because I don't know how that came about. And we will never know. We will never, ever, I guess, find out if that young man was the arson. But the state police and the arson investigation group had no doubt about the scientific evidence that indeed arson had been part of that fire, that it had not happened accidentally. They found gasoline or whatever in seven or eight places throughout the house.
So that's why it went up so quickly.
I didn't understand at the time.
Sure.
It all made sense to me 4 or 5 days later when it was beyond any shred of doubt that there was in fact arson involved.
Let's move on and kind of tie this up. This event really, do I understand correctly that this was the catalyst that got Fraternity Renaissance going?
Yeah, I'm sorry to get into so much detail about this particular fire.
No, I'm very glad to have the story.
Well, let me quickly finish the story, then I will get to the main point of what the good that came out of this tragedy. Mm-hmm. Thank goodness. The scene moves on. The young man in question was not immediately, I guess, identified, but for whatever reason, his own parents institutionalized him immediately. He was beyond the reach of the police for 3 or 4 months. I guess he was identified fairly early on. Maybe the story came out from the Hollins College, and I guess, you know, people over there were very suspicious that he'd had his, because he had made the threat, and apparently the threat had been heard by just one or two young women, but several others. And so, for whatever reason, he was beyond question. Meantime, we were just simply dealing with the aftermath over here, and the house was just a shambles, and it was a great shock. As you can imagine, that kind of tragedy would be for any student body of any college of any size. State universities that have lost fraternities through fire are numbed by such an experience, and a little college like ours, of course, was. Anyway, to really bring it to the end, I remember the somewhere around the following September, the young man came out of wherever he had been institutionalized over the summer, and the police nabbed him in 24 hours and literally put him in the Lexington, Rockridge County Jail. I guess they had enough evidence, they thought they had enough evidence for that. And the trial came up, the arson murder trial came up in the following December during the December holidays after Christmas, around the 27th, 28th, 29th, during that period of time. I remember Mr. and Mrs. Fellin wanted to come down to the trial, and I had continued to correspond with them and chat with them on the phone rather frequently during that period of time. And I tried to talk them out of coming, because I said, you know, I remember saying this to them and writing this to them, you could be letting yourself in for the second greatest disappointment in your life. The loss of your son, of course, being number one, but that, as I said to them, and what I had heard from all the investigators, it's rather easy to prove arson. What's difficult is proving who lit the match. And without getting into all the evidence they had and the witnesses they thought they had and this, that, and the other, and how the
the trial came unglued when the prosecuting attorney made some mistakes. But you know, there was all sorts of stuff, and the jailbird confession, everything he admitted to his cellmate that he had done it. There was all sorts of reasons to suspect, at least, that he probably had done it. The fact is that he walked scot-free and can never be tried again because of the prosecutorial error that was made by the Commonwealth's attorney. I remember dealing with the Fallon family in that aftermath, which was worse than in the first aftermath. They were stunned for at least an hour. And the university, at my request, had complimented them, put them up down at the Campbell Inn, so they were close by the courthouse, and I thought that was the least we could do, and John Wilson agreed with me. And they were there for 3 or 4 days during this trial, and of course, this fraternity guys were back, and so that was a second trauma, frankly, to go through that, because the students were quite upset that the person that they thought had burned their house down and in fact, in the process, murdered their great friend and leader, was going to go free, and they were very upset with the university, as a matter of fact, because the universities at that time employed a council, and that particular council was free to also take on other work, and so he was a part of the defense team for the young man that was acquitted, as it were. Not acquitted, but at the same time when the case was thrown out. And that's something good that came out of that trial. The Board of Trustees at its next meeting, I think, in reaction to that situation, well, we now have an in-house counsel, but there was no question that we would never have any kind of the appearance of a conflict of interest again by our own lawyer representing the other side of a case that was that traumatic for the university. So that was one nice little good, at least good thing that came out of it. Well, let's move off of the subject, as you suggested, about the trauma of the loss and all of that. And move to what really happened in the aftermath. What happened in the aftermath is that through the singular leadership of Edward L. Bishop, class of 68, and the Alumni House Corporation, the determination was made instantly to rebuild that fraternity house and to build it back better than ever and build it in such a way that it would be a model fraternity. We didn't know at the time it would be a fraternity renaissance model, but we just decided it was right to put it back. Now, what made that easy was that we were well insured, and so we had a fairly good slug of insurance money to work with. I want to say $350,000 or something in that vicinity.
Newspaper said 385.
Okay, yeah, well, I'm close then. No, my memory's not bad. And so that was a help. I remember at the time John Wilson said to me, "Dick, don't dare let those five games spend over $500,000 on that house." I said, "John, I forget how many square feet in that house." I said, "We'll never build it for anything less than 750, and that's about what it did cost to rebuild. But Ed Bishop and his cohorts who were alumni really did a great job to rebuild that house. And because we could more or less start from scratch, the some of the stone walls were still standing, although 4 or 5 days after the fire, one or two of them began to cave in. But the front facade of the house and one side was pretty well intact. One whole side and the entire rear stone wall, that all fell through. But they piled the stones up over in one corner of the yard and determined to rebuild it. Well, for the best part of a year or so, it was a macabre scene to see this house with this wreckage. It was talk about the wreck of the sloop John B. This house was a great scar on the landscape up on that wonderful corner.
And that house, we, for a long time, we talked about historic preservation and whether or not we could get some tax deductible credit, because it was a historic house. Plus the fact that house anchors one of the most important streets in Lexington. The whole Jackson Avenue, Preston Street intersection is such an important corner in this town, and that house was really important, so it had to be done right. And I, along with others, wanted to build it back exactly the way it was, not just to bulldoze it over and build a modern house there, but to try to preserve the 19th century character of the whole neighborhood. So we'll give the Five Games credit a little bit there for also agreeing and having the determination to do it that way. So Ed Bishop and his friends began to develop a fundraising plan, and we got some pretty good fundraising help from the son of Earl Palmer Brown. Jeb Brown was a Phi Gamma class of 69. So we got some fairly sophisticated brochures that they could mail to the 500 or 600, 700, whatever it was, Phi Gamma alumni. And so people began to rally a little bit and talk about how we could contribute and do. And as it turned out, several major donors did appear, bless their hearts, to invest heavily into a limited partnership. I won't get into all the technicalities of that because I don't understand it myself. But to make a long story short, Ed Bishop is a financial wizard. Horton, MBA, Wall Street genius, and otherwise. As a matter of fact, you'll probably be the next chairman of the Washington Lake Board of Trustees Investment Committee. But Ed is had the financial acumen to really know how to put this program together, and did so. And my job, I guess, during this period was to hold the hands of the impatient students, try to keep the fraternity together. They were had located themselves over I guess it was Henry Street somewhere, in the shack over there, and try to go through Rush without a fraternity and all that sort of thing. And of course, a batch of 20-year-olds can't understand why you can't rebuild the house immediately. We still, amazingly enough, rebuilt that house. As I look back, I think we were back and open for business probably 2 years later. It was quickly done. And as it seemed like forever at the time, of course, to me and to the students. To me and my family, because the place, believe it or not, smells so bad. I mean, a charred fire of that size and scope just smells bad for a year. I'm serious. A year later, you can still see, in the atmosphere, you can still smell that thing. But the house, I remember saying to Ed that if he would let me design the basement, I made the claim. I said, I'll make the whole house work. And he said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, Ed, I think every fraternity at Washlay has in common basements where the students tend to do all their partying, or most of their partying, and every single one of them are claustrophobic. They have low ceilings, typically 7.5 feet or 7 feet and 8 at max. So I said to him, you give me the basement, you let me be your design person in the basement, I think we could make this whole thing work. He said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, what I want to do is dig the foundation deeper, and so that we can get about a 10-foot ceiling in the basement. Then let's get available light, because most of the fraternity basements around were dark, pitch dark if the lights went out, because there's no light. So let's get some English window wells, and let's get some Dutch doors or whatever. Let's make it so that you can get light in there. And then let's build in a bandstand so the kids don't have to reinvent the wheel every time there's a combo coming to play. And let's dedicate a chapter room down there for all their secret fraternity paraphernalia where they can do their initiations. And let's put, yes, a drain in the middle of the concrete floor so we can hose the place out. And let's build in a bar and let's go about calling a spade and make this
a party bunker, as it were. But let's make sure.
Need to turn the tape over.
Okay.